This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, just when you thought the blip was over, along comes Manchester City to remind you that you can never actually relax. Two goals to the good against Crystal Palace and absolutely cruising, and suddenly the run extends to just one win in the last six Premier League games. You've got to go back to March 2016 to find the last time that happened. But at least Pep Guardiola's side have made it through to the Club World Cup final on Friday. We'll look ahead to the game with Fluminense and the return of Premier League action as City go to Goodison Park after Christmas. At least Everton haven't suddenly found some good form. Oh, yeah, right, okay. We'll speak to the Blue Room's David Downey a little later on to find out why things have improved for them. Then this week we celebrated a special City anniversary. On Tuesday, it was 25 years since the infamous defeat at York, what's widely considered to be City's lowest point. On today's Blue Moon podcast, we'll hear from a load of the players who were in that squad, plus the City fan who was the mascot at Bootham Crescent that day. Stay tuned for that. That is all to come. I'm David Mooney. With me this week is City fan Richard Burns.
Hello, David.
And One Football's Dan Burke.
Hello, lads. Season's greetings.
Season's greetings, indeed. Richard, season's greetings. You well?
Season's greetings. Yes, I am. Thank you. Are you, David?
Season's greetings. I am. Yes. There we are.
Good tidings to all men and women.
God bless us, everyone.
We're going to talk about your... While we're having a bit of a laugh at the start of the show, we're going to talk about York away a bit later on. Is there any anniversary from City's history that isn't remembered that absolutely should be, Richard? Anything for you that stands out?
The anniversary of Wilfred Bonny tweeting good 3 points. Should be a national holiday.
Kieran Murray does his best to remember that every single time City win. We haven't seen it a lot lately, but you know. Yeah, Dan, any for you? Any anniversaries that should be remembered that aren't?
The first one that springs to mind is Cass Verdict Day.
Yes.
That was one of my favourite ever days as a City fan. We didn't even play a match. It was just wonderful, wasn't it, from start to finish? Who knows, maybe we'll get another one like it next year.
Yeah, well, keep rack up the charges, I say. Keep giving us these days in court,
And also with sort of the York away theme, the one that often gets overlooked is the Mansfield Auto Windscreens Shield game at Lane Road. What was it? I'd read like a Where Are They Now Athletic long read about the, 3,007 people that turned up for that one.
Yeah, that was it 3,000. Were you among them?
I was not. No,
were you not, Richard?
I took Joe Rowles' advice and stayed at home.
he did say don't come, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, I've forgotten all about that.
I didn't go. I think I'd wanted to, but I it would have been my dad that I would have gone with, and I'm pretty sure he was working away that night, so I watched it on TV, and I was glad I didn't go in the end.
Excellent. Can if anybody that was there is listening, get in touch with us. I'd love to know if you were one of the 3,007. I've got the team up. Let me read the team from that game. Tommy Wright was in goal. One of the defenders, S. Rimmer. Simon Rimmer? Stephen Rimmer? I don't know who that is.
Simon Rimmer's a chef, isn't he?
Is he? He is. Yes, he is. Nick Fenton, Tony Vaughan, Danny Teato, Jamie Pollock, Michael Brown, Jeff Whitley, Neil Heaney, Gareth Taylor, Danny Allsop started the game. Actually, for that season, that's not a bad side, really.
All the stars are here.
I've made a mistake there. I've got Jay Whitley as starting, and Jay Whitley came off the bench. So both Jim and Jeff were involved, but I don't know which started and which came off the bench because they're both just down as Jay Whitley. And then Alan Bailey came off the bench as well, who I think scored for Stockport against City a few years later.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Those were the days, eh?
Yeah.
Well, none of that anymore. Let's talk about some top of the table football. Tis the season for festive football, and the best way to watch it if you can't get to the games, down at your local Green King Sports pub, of course. After all, Christmas is a time to catch up with friends, old and new. So get the team to your local for pints, food, and live action of every Christmas cracker. Each game from TNT, Sky, and Amazon is live at Green King Sports. That includes Friday's game with Fluminense, and I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that a kickoff on a Friday at 6 p.m. would be good for a few finishing work. And also the midweek trip to Goodison Park next week as well. There's wall-to-wall action on their huge HD screens. Head to your local Green King and watch every winning goal, top bins volley, and dodgy VAR decision in an atmosphere worth sharing. Don't forget, download the Green King Sports app and you'll receive 10% off drinks every single time there's sport on the telly. We can put it off no longer, fellas. We're going to have to talk about whatever happened against Crystal Palace. And Dan, ahead of the game, you're on the show last week, ahead of the game, I must admit I was feeling fairly confident that City would just do it. And, you know, we had quite a positive show last week thinking about the same sort of thing. that's now Palace, Spurs, Liverpool, Chelsea, where City have been leading really late on, and they haven't won any of them. Like, are you concerned by this now?
I am, yeah, and I think it's hard to put a finger on what is going wrong because I think the circumstances in each game are quite different. You know, like Chelsea and Spurs were both sort of ding-dong games, weren't the end-to-end stuff. Maybe a draw was a fair result in both of them. I'd say it probably was. Liverpool game, it was never over at 1-0, and ultimately I don't think we did enough to win anyway, so you take the one on the chin. The Palace one's definitely the most frustrating because of the level of the opposition and the fact it felt in the bag when Rico Lewis scored, didn't it? It felt like, oh, we've got this one. We'll see this out no problem at all. You know, I'd probably include the Arsenal game in the same category as those ones as well, in that, you know, we lost a 0-0 draw 1-0 that day, and that was really annoying as well. I think you can point to individual errors as to why things are going wrong. You know, the Diaz giving the penalty away against Chelsea, Foden giving the ball away, then giving the penalty away against Palace. You know, the whole team are definitely switching off and not seeing games out in an intelligent way, in the way that we've become accustomed to. And, you know, perhaps fatigue is a factor. I feel like the game at the weekend, I can feel myself yearning for players like Riyad Mahrez, you know, who would sort of come on maybe in a game where we're 2-0 up and get the third, the fourth goal, see it out. I don't feel like we've got that player in the squad anymore that's doing that for us.
It's really funny.
Problem.
Yeah, it's really funny you say that as well, because people always used to criticise Mahrez for not scoring enough crucial goals. And now you look at it and like that third goal is actually really crucial, isn't it?
yeah. And you know, maybe Gundogan was chipping in with them as well. Like the goals output is still really good. It's just we're not scoring goals in the right time in a weird way.
Yeah. Richard, are you starting to sense that anxiety creeping in because this sort of thing keeps happening, if you know what I mean? Like they were absolutely cruising against Palace, and then it goes to 2-1 with about 15 minutes to go. And then like everywhere, the players, the fans, everyone was just like, well, better not happen again, had it?
Yeah, massively. I think like last season, or well, more specifically the back end of last season, if we'd have conceded a goal at 2-0 up, then I think this kind of situation where I would have found myself thinking, well, not ideal, but it wouldn't have particularly had me worried that that we were going to drop the points. Like I'd have sort of backed City to just step it up a gear and go and make sure, or at least see it out, you know, and sort of think how defensively solid they were in the back end of last season. And now it's just that thing of everybody, there's mistakes creeping in individually, the team is dropping off as a collective, and we've lost that. I think there's the other side of it, where the psychological effect for the other team of knowing that City now have this in them is that they no longer feel invincible, do they? Because they're not. So
they're very invincible at the moment. Yeah,
they're very invincible. Yeah. So like last season, to go 1-0 up from what, March onwards, felt like you'd won the game already, and teams would be understandably coming to the Etihad. And I suppose that's not even just last season. That's up until like almost the beginning of this month or end of November. Teams would be coming to the Etihad knowing City's record there, and it's that thing, isn't it, of almost like being beaten before they go on the pitch. And all of a sudden, we're seeing the sort of chink in the armour. And you see Crystal Palace, knowing that they've got like one goal back at the Etihad, will suddenly feel naturally emboldened because they'll be able to point to other teams who have rescued losing situations against City. And of course, you know, you can look and say all of those teams are higher profile, they're better teams than Crystal Palace. But the point is, what City are experiencing, it's like that sheen and is just wearing off a little bit, and City must feel that. Jack Grealish spoke after the Madrid game last year, certainly in that run at the end of the season, when he said they don't feel like they can lose, and now it almost looks like they've sort of forgotten that they can win.
Yeah, it's just getting over the line seems really hard at the minute. How terminal do you think this last 6 weeks has been to the season, in your opinion, Dan? It's obviously, you look at the setup of the table. They don't play this weekend when everyone else plays, so it will look worse come what may. But, I mean, they're not that far off the top of the table. They have had a real sticky 6 weeks. It's a case of sort that out and actually should be all right. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we're 5 points off the top, so it's not massively terminal, is it? It's a surmountable lead, definitely. And at the same time, it's incredibly frustrating to be dropping silly points, and it can't go on because, you know, at some point it's gonna get out of hand if we're not careful. But at some point, we could also just click into our flow. And if that happens, you know, when it happens, will be a big problem for other teams in the league. And, you know, it's eight points drop from winning position since the last international break. And if we'd not done that, we'd be top of the league. Like, I know that's a big if, but I just hope it's a bit of a wake-up call now, because if they do snap out of this funk quickly, like, we can get back into the title race, no problem, and everyone will be really fearful of us.
Yeah, I did let me talk with Sam Lee earlier this week, Richard, and we rewatched the final 30 minutes of the game and reacted to it as it was happening. And the reason was, like, during the game, both of us felt like the game had lulled, like City got too passive, they'd lost control of the game. And actually, when you watch it back, it doesn't really feel like that in the cold light of day. Like, obviously, like, go and have a listen to that, everybody who's listening to this, because you don't have to be a member to hear that bit. It was on the free feed as well. And it really opened my eyes how wrong I felt about the end of the Palace game. City didn't allow Palace a chance to build any encouragement after their goal for 2-1. They didn't try and force it too much by attempting to kind of just steamroller Palace towards the end of the game. But they were still attempting positive passes and, like, positive moves, trying to get in behind Palace and, like, all the time, but not force it. And there was absolutely no threat from Palace until the 91st minute. So all of that said, City won the stats, but they drew the game. So that there is still something wrong, isn't there, Richard?
Yeah, and I think it... I mean, clearly you've done much more work into trying to put your finger on it than I've done. And I think that's a really interesting reflection. And it's really good to step back and, I guess, like, rationalise how you feel watching a game and then actually reflect on the reality.
Yeah, and I just think when Guardiola watches it back, he won't see that much wrong with it, you know.
No, and he did say after the game, didn't he, about, like, they were really good and there were so many good actions. And, it did seem fairly genuine. He didn't look like he was just protecting them, but obviously that frustration is still there, dropping the points. But I think that almost plays more to the fact that there is a problem, because all of those things are true of City when they're at their best, and I think speaks to that, you know, attempts to control games. But there's still something in that final bit of, whether it's decision-making, Dan mentioned earlier, like Foden losing the ball where he lost it, and then Silva, and I'll say I've not watched it back, so maybe it was the right decision at the time, but I think he tried his turn on the touchline that resulted in City losing the ball. And then Foden, sort of, the attempted tackle was pretty wild in the box at such a crucial time of the game. And it's just, that's the stuff that feels like something's wrong. It's not the wider play. City is still an exceptional football team, but it's those little moments that weren't going wrong last season when they were really really in their best flow, that now, again, it's just that they're not invincible, and maybe it's just individual moments of panic or just bad judgment that is still contributing to, for all those things that you've just said that are absolutely true. They've still conceded two goals at home to Palace, having had the points seemingly wrapped up.
Yeah. Dan, does that suggest to you that there are no major issues to fix and it's only minor things, which actually could be quite an easy fix come the end of the season?
Yeah, it does actually. I mean, perhaps it's an oversimplistic way of looking at it, but I think it's a much easier problem to solve than if we were conceding late goals and losing games or, you know, not scoring many goals. Like I said, we're top scorers in the league. I think I said last week on the podcast that we're about 85% there, and I think that game sort of proved my point in an annoying way on Saturday. I think if it's just the case of us saying, come on, lads, we're pretty much winning games here, let's redouble our effort, shut up shop, see them out in the final minutes, that should be fairly easy to figure out, I think. But whether they will do that, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people are sort of expecting, oh, don't worry. I think certainly our rivals in the title race are thinking City will go on this 15-match winning streak. Ultimately, it'll be fine. And I don't know if we are good enough to do that this season. I don't know if we have the depth and the energy to do that. Let's find out. I hope they do, of course. But I think, you know, just getting back to basics and just seeing these games out first and foremost is what we need to do.
Yeah. Quick one, Dan. Foul on Bernardo at the end?
I thought at the time it was. I think I was maybe clutching at straws. I think you've definitely seen them given, but I don't think you can expect to get a foul there.
Yeah. sometimes you get them, sometimes you don't. I think we should have had it, but there we go. Let's talk about the game against Red Diamonds as well, because...
Against who?
Red Diamonds. I knew you were going to do this. I knew you were going to do this, because I can't say the first bit. Urawa, Red Diamonds.
Let me ask you a question then. When Sam Lee does you a favour, have you ever said to him, you are a Red Diamond?
I haven't, no.
Because that's an easy way to remember how to pronounce it, I think.
Okay, you are a Red Diamond. There we go.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, so thank you very much for bringing up the fact that I can't say it. Fine. Let's talk about that game. Richard, I'm going to come to you because Dan's pissed me off. I was pretty sceptical about this, but I'm wondering if there are benefits to this Club World Cup at the moment, given that they're competitive games in the sense of the club wants to win the tournament and wants to do well against opposition that are a bit pre-season friendly, like in a country where they're effectively having a warm weather kind of trip away for a bit at a time when things are not going right for them domestically. So they can just kind of blow the cobwebs out and go and play some nice football somewhere else for a bit.
Yeah, I don't really see a downside other than, you know, I suppose you don't necessarily want to have a situation where the postponed games, you know, become a problem later and have to be slotted in somewhere, which I don't think has been sorted yet. But we get that every season anyway, for one reason or another. So, like, other than that, I think it's all upside. Like, I agree with Pep's point that, like, it's a privilege to be able to play in this competition. It might be like second rate in terms of trophies that you want to win, and I wouldn't miss it if it wasn't there. But you have to remember, like, why we're in this, and it's because we've just won the Champions League off the back of being one of the best teams in club football history. Like, this is a competition that the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona take seriously. Whenever they go there, they want to win it, so it's certainly not too good for Manchester City. And then, like, yeah, the opponents might not be the best. I'll level with you, and I know you've again put the work in, David. I don't know loads about Fluminense, or if I'm even saying that right. Fluminense, is that right?
Honestly, mate, I'm not the person to ask with bad pronunciations, really, am I?
Dan, any tips?
Have you ever asked Sam? No.
I think it's. To be able to go and play a game that wasn't the most intense, but get a 3-0 win under our belts, I think you could see from the players' celebrations, they clearly don't regard it as the most important or most difficult game that they're going to play this season. But if you're in it, you might as well try and win it. If we don't, then okay, it'll be
Mickey Mouse Cup, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but like, no, it's like the Super League. Sorry, not the Super League, the Super Cup or the Charity Shield. Like, if you're going to play it, you might as well try and win it. If you're going to sit down and watch it, you might as well want your team to win. And if you lose it, then it's not going to ruin anybody's weekend, is it? There's a nice novelty to being in it. It's hard earned, and there's a reason that we're in it that we should be very, very happy with and should be really proud of. Or, you know, at least the players should be proud of for how they've got there. And after that, I agree with everything that you said. It's a good chance to get away from a more intense Christmas schedule and play some, hopefully, lighter touch games and just build a bit of confidence back in and get some flow back into, get some rhythm back.
Yeah, you never know. It might actually become the Super League as of next season, given the expansion plans to it. Yeah. Dan, there were a few standout players from the game, and I know we have to kind of analyse it with the level of the opposition taken into account. But for a player who has come in and kind of had a slow start to his City career, I thought Matheus Nunes was pretty good. And Kovacic got himself on the score sheet, something that he's been desperate to do all season.
Yeah, Nunes, I think he has been underwhelming so far, and obviously he's missed some time with injury, which hasn't helped. But I also think we are being a little bit harsh on him, and he deserves a bit more patience. You know, he's not a Kevin De Bruyne replacement and shouldn't be considered one. That was not what he was brought to the club to be. He's been brought in to do a different role, and, you know, ball carrying is not a very glamorous role, but perhaps quite an important role. And I think, you know, if Pep has identified him as a player that can be useful to us, then we should trust Pep in that regard. And I'm sure there's a lot for Nunes to learn. turn, and he's probably a little bit, you know, shy at the moment or whatever, not, you know, coming out of his shell, a little bit tentative. And, you know, give him a chance, he might be all right, or he might be complete shit. I think it's just too early to say, really. Mm. And yeah, with Kovacic, I guess he's kind of in the same boat. Maybe he's a little bit further along in his development than Nunez as a City player. It was really nice to see him get that goal. I thought he was a bit Gundogan-esque. The thing that a lot of people say about Kovacic is that, oh, he's not Gundogan. You know what? We've downgraded him massively there, and I tend to agree. But I also think that it's interesting that Gundogan is only really remembered for all the great games he had and the big goals he scored. Because for me, I think there was a lot of games where he didn't do an awful lot, and I found it quite frustrating and underwhelming sometimes too, especially sort of in the early years. And obviously, Gundogan earned his legacy over time and should be remembered as one of the greats. But you know, I think we can also take from that Kovacic and Nunez deserve time and patience too. And it's only December. They only joined in the summer, you know. People are expecting a lot from them quite too soon, in my opinion.
Yeah. Speaking of expecting too much too soon, let's go back to when City expected to blitz a league and they didn't. Earlier this week, it was the 25th anniversary of what's widely considered to be City's lowest ever point. On the 19th of December 1998, City travelled to York in Division 2, what's now known as League 1. And defeat that afternoon left them in 12th in the table. And while they'd been lower earlier in the season, this was further from the promotion places points-wise than the fans ever expected to be. Here's a look at the year. It really was an unhappy Christmas. The 1998-99 season was supposed to be easy.
The club is and was too big for the second division, and everybody expected us to come straight back up, and I think even the players they thought it would be easy to be champions, but it was very difficult, and we got out, but we should have been champions or second place to go automatically up. But yeah, we did it the hard way.
That's defender Gerard Vikins. He'd joined City at the beginning of the season before, expecting to challenge for promotion back to the Premier League. It all went wrong. The club were instead relegated to Division 2, what's now known as League 1. And what he says is true. Many of us were expecting City to bounce back easily and quickly. Defender Lee Crooks remembers it the same way.
Being such a big club like Man City and then getting relegated 2 seasons on trot, not really good news, so we knew the pressure was going to be on it. But every time, you know, we had teams coming to Main Road, it was like an FA Cup final for, you know, for them to come to Main Road. So I think more or less their game plan was to try and keep us quiet for 20 minutes, hoping that the crowd would get on our backs, and then it'd all, you know, go to ratchet really, like. But yeah, it was pretty hard, and it was an hard season. Down in Division 2, yeah, definitely. Especially the first half of the season, we were really struggling.
And it's the same story for Richard Edgell.
It was difficult because I think we were getting a lot of stick as well because of the results. We weren't beating teams as comfortably as probably the fans would have liked, so we were getting a lot of stick off our own fans as well as the away fans as well. So it was difficult to say. I think we just wanted to get on a good run and got a few good results together.
After beating Blackpool on the opening day, City lost to Fulham and drew with Wrexham and Notts County. After 4 games, they were 14th. They've never been lower in the Football League pyramid. The form continued in much the same way too, and when City went to Bootham Crescent, they were winless in their last 4 games. Draws with Gillingham and Bristol Rovers at Main Road sandwiched a draw at Luton, all of which came off the back of a defeat at Wickham. After 21 games, City had won just 7 and languished in 9th place. Then came York. Nicky Weaver was in goal.
I remember going to York the week before Christmas when we lost 2-1 and we ended up being 12th at Christmas. But then everything turned around. We signed Andy Morrison. The GOAT started firing. And we had a really good, I think, so like the last 23 games, we only lost maybe 3, something like that.
A lot of the players I've interviewed always focused on what happened next. Wrexham on Boxing Day is rightly considered a turning point. Here's midfielder Kevin Horlock.
I think it was away to Wrexham, I think it was, Boxing Day. I think I took a corner and Gerard Vikin scored. And then from that day, we went on just a mad run of winning games, and it did look like we were going to sneak in, and we didn't. And the worrying thing about that is, you get so close and then have that disappointment, and it sometimes have a negative effect on you going into playoffs because you're on a low, where someone that sneaked into the playoffs is in a high of getting there.
Horlock's fellow midfielder Michael Brown says things were getting desperate behind the scenes. He outlines how it might have been different if City had also failed to beat Wrexham.
Only years later did I find out that Joe Royal was going to be sacked at the end of that game. And I found out that it looked like he was, that the board were going to sack him, but we nicked through. And the rest was history. We managed to crack on and finally get to Wembley at an amazing day.
However, the chairman at the time, David Bernstein, denies that they were considering sacking the manager. Either way, it underlines the pressure that the club was under and the job that Royal and his team had to do. Bernstein says they were always planning to stick with the boss.
First of all, the rumours are completely untrue. We had great confidence in Joe Royal. It's one of those situations. We seem to be doing all the right things. We signed some good players. We were appearing to do everything right, and yet the results weren't coming through at the time.
Immediately after that York game, the winds did start to change. Not that anyone knew it at the time. Up next was Stoke at Main Road, another pivotal match.
I remember we were 1-0 down at half-time and it was all looking pretty desperate, and I think there was a big barley in the dressing room at half-time, as I understand it. I mean, I wasn't there. And we came out and we won that game, and then we never looked back after that.
Losing 1-0 at half-time to Stoke, Paul Dickoff equalised with 25 minutes to go. The winning goal came late on, and it was Gareth Taylor's first for the club.
My debut was at Luton away and we drew 1-1, and then, like I say, we had the Christmas period, and the Wrexham game was a big game, and I always remember it being a bog of a pitch. It was a hell of a downpour, and it was unlikely the game would go ahead, and it did, and we won that one, and Gerrard scored a good goal. And the Stoke game was a big game because they were going for it as well that season, and I'd had a goal disallowed just before I scored, actually, which was a disappointment. But now I remember, I was actually, someone showed it to me on a video the other day, and it was Dickie who's gone down the left side, cut back in, put a great cross in, and I've got my first goal, which is a fantastic feeling.
It's difficult to pinpoint exactly what changed. This is what Joe Royal told us about why the form improved.
I think we came to terms with the division. We came to terms with every game at Main Road being the biggest game of the season for the visiting side. In some ways more than their home game, because Main Road was a stadium that they might never play on again. There's certainly nothing that size. It was a hard division. It wasn't a great division.
After defeat at York in December 1998, City lost only twice more in 24 games, winning 15 of them. It wasn't quite enough to sneak into the automatic promotion places, but it did give us that iconic playoff final against Gillingham. Whenever I've asked, Royal will never say that what he and the team achieved built a platform for the modern City, but he does agree that they put a support under the club when it was badly needed.
The biggest consequence, of course, is the fans had stayed with us. Everywhere we went, we broke records with the away fans, and the anomaly of sometimes, fans bringing more games to Main Road than they had for home games. We're making a weekend of it in Manchester and going to the theatre and enjoying the big stadium, bring the wife, bring the kids. And there we were, I don't know that the fans would have stayed with us another season to that extent. I like to think that they would. And I always say, that the City fans are the best in the business, because no other club of their size has had to endure the pain and the anguish that they have, and then they stood by it. Whether or not that would have gone into a second season, I don't know.
Trips like that one to Bootham Crescent in December 1998 feel like only yesterday, but they also feel a world away from what's happening these days too. City have never been out of the Premier League now since their return in 2002. The Pep Guardiola era has been the most successful in the team's history, though we all know and understand the role that Sheikh Mansour's investments has played in that. There aren't many football fans who can say they've seen their club's best years and their lowest point in such a short space of time.
Hi there, this is Joe Royal speaking. You're listening to the Blue Moon podcast, and carry on doing so.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
So that was a look at one of the worst ever days to be a City fan. Us three had a pretty bad day that afternoon, but let's speak to someone now whose day could possibly be considered even worse. City fan Dan Mayers joins us. Welcome to the show, Dan. Explain to us why that York game is both good and bad for you.
Well, it's good because it's the first proper game I remember, because I was 6 years old. I'm from York, so getting to meet all the players on the day was fantastic. The actual experience was amazing. But when you look back now, you think, oh, that was one of the lowest points of Man City's career, and I was a mascot for that day. You're like, I can't believe it.
Yeah, you were leading the team out. Who did you walk out with? Who was the captain that day?
Oh, God.
I've got a feeling it might have been someone like Jamie Pollock, would it have been?
Yeah, I think it was Jamie Pollock. Yeah, it was, because when we did the warm-up, he let me join in the warm-up as well.
Yeah. So what was the entire experience like? You're there, you're leading the team out. You're obviously City are at like a pretty low point in their footballing kind of experience. But for you yourself, like at 6 years old, everything must be great, mustn't it?
Oh, of course it was. It's like no prior experience leading your team out. Even if it's against York City, wasn't a problem. It's like there's no prouder moment. My mum and dad were in the crowd watching me. Probably the best day of my dad's life as well, watching his son lead the team out. And then, yeah, because it wasn't a great result, but it was still one of the best days I can remember.
So what was happening during the game? Because like you've led the team out, you've done the warm-up, the game's going on. Where are you then? Did you get a seat in the stands, or were you in like hospitality, anything like that? I don't know what hospitality at York could look like, but you know.
I thought it was non-existent at York, but we went into the away ground, away end, back with my mum and dad. But beforehand, you go through into the changing rooms, you got all the signatures from the players, got to see the manager, talk to everybody, and then say, game kicks off, you go into the away and watch the game and don't enjoy it as much as you possibly could. But it was still a great day regardless.
Yeah. You say you're from York, what was school like then the next day? Had you broken up for Christmas by this point? Did you not have to suffer the school playground after losing at York?
Oh no, school was still rough, don't get me wrong. School was rough for all my life, but being a City fan, because we got taken the mick out of by everybody, Newcastle fans, United fans, Arsenal fans, it didn't matter.
Yeah, well, Dan, thank you very much for joining us. It's obviously I was going to say a painful day, but you'll have better memories of it than most of us will. Then, in that case, will you?
Yeah, I mean, when people say to me who do you support, I always say Man City, and they go, "Oh, you must have been a City fan since 2008." I go, "Oh, actually, no. I was a mascot against York City back in 1998-99 season."
And yeah, there is literally photographic evidence of you at York away, isn't there? Yeah, I've never thought of it like that.
Yeah, so I always show that pitch and they go, "Oh, okay, well, we'll let you off then."
Yeah, well, Dan, thank you very much for joining us. It's honestly, it's put it into perspective where I think of where things were for City at the time.
Oh, well, it wasn't great then. It's great now, so it's been worth going through it all.
Lovely stuff. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Dan Mayers there, who was City's mascot for York away, the trip to Booth and Crescent. Richard, Dan, for us on this one, we're slightly older than Dan. What are your memories of that game? Richard, where were you when everything was going to shit at York?
So I think I was in Wales at my grandparents. And this is one of those things where it's possibly a bit of a misremembered. I definitely remember being at my grandparents in December when City lost an away game in Division Two. And so it's sort of in my head, I've absolutely just made it this game and like following the scores on teletext.
Yeah.
Which would have been like wherever I was, I would have almost been certainly following the scores on teletext. And it was like a proper, this is one of those points where I would have been 10. It was my first year with a season ticket. And there was that line of City's lowest ever point. Like, there was definitely that feeling to me of, like, why is this my era? Like, why have I picked up a season ticket at the point where there was sort of everybody had high hopes that they'd win the league, they were too big to be down there, and all that kind of stuff. And actually, it's embarrassing, and it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. But in a weird way, it's one of those things that, like, if you're 10 and you're going through that and you still want to carry on going, it just further cements you sort of, like, I'm in this for life already. There's no going back. It's that, as happens to every football fan, it's already got its hold on me.
Yeah, that sounds like Stockholm syndrome to me, though.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, York syndrome. York syndrome for City fans.
Yeah. Dan, where were you?
To be honest, I have no real memory of the game itself. I think I was a bit oblivious to the kind of scale of the situation at the time, which was probably a bit of a blessing looking back. I just knew that it was dire for City and not enjoyable to watch at all. I mean, I absolutely hated going to Main Road back then. Mm. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, I was very jealous of all the kids at school who supported United and what they were experiencing at the time. And, you know, even like Arsenal were a team that I sort of looked at and was like, why can't my team play football like them? Why have we got all these shite players playing on muddy pitches in, you know, Lincoln and York and places like that? And like, you know, my family never went to away games back then either, so I can't even relate to people saying how great it was to visit all these different grounds and all these different clubs. It was just
just a string of new teams that came to Main Road and took points off us. Yeah.
and weirdly, you know, I am nostalgic for that time, but I think it's a lot easier to look back on fondly at something like that when you know what came after. Yeah. And I don't even mean just the 25 years afterwards, like just the playoff final that year was like a happy ending to a horror story, basically. And at the time, it wasn't enjoyable to live through. And I am quite skeptical of anyone who says it was, to be honest.
I think that's the key, isn't it? I mean, you say you didn't like going to Main Road at that time. Like, I think when we look back at what Main Road was like at that time, it's very easy to get wrapped up in that, oh, it was great, the noise was fantastic, and it was really loud under the lights sort of thing. And it just wasn't. It was really loud, but it was really poisonous, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and you look, the support we got that season was obviously phenomenal for that level, you know, from the first game of the season against Blackpool, 30,000, it pretty much remained constant throughout the season, but it was quite poisonous and toxic, as you say. And, you know, I'm sure there was fun to be had for those people who went to away games, and, you know, a lot of gallows humour. And I think that time was very character building for a lot of City fans of our generation. But yeah, it was a miserable time for the most part. And I think it should be remembered as such, while at the same time being remembered as like a really interesting, esoteric and, you know, quite comical chapter in City's history. And one of the big ironies for me is that the worst team we've ever had wore the best kit we've ever had.
Which, are you talking laser blue or are you talking the playoff final kit?
I'm talking laser blue, yeah. That playoff final kit is a monstrosity, which has only been remembered fondly because of the playoff final, I think.
Absolutely hard agree on that one as well. Richard, the other side of this is...
Well, the other side of this is that the laser blue kit was appalling.
Well, no, it isn't. That's just not true. What are you talking about?
It's the wrong colour. It's the wrong colour.
I'm honestly lost for words.
Yeah, same.
It's such a beautiful piece of City's history.
The year we played in the wrong colour.
We had a few years of laser blue, to be fair. It was our colour for a while, wasn't it?
It's not an appalling kit in of itself. It's not a City kit. It's the wrong blue.
I tell you, that kit that they had a few years ago with the purple on the sleeves, that was the wrong kit. Because you don't have purple on a City kit, but laser blue is like, it's an iconic City colour now.
Bring it back, I say.
No. It became
an iconic City colour. That kit launched it. It was fantastic.
Well, then I counter by saying Wembley 99 launched that kit as an iconic City kit, because why wouldn't it? Because of course you remember your kits by the occasions that they're worn and played in.
I'm not saying that the Wembley 99 kit isn't an iconic kit. I'm saying it's hideous.
Well, I mean, I won't argue as... I like it. I won't argue as strongly on that point. The other one is not a City kit.
Fine. All right. Let's go back to things we can agree on then. In that case, what I was going to ask Richard is, I guess it's important to contextualise City's era in the third tier. And you said yourself about why is this my era sort of feeling that you were having. I mean, the first thing is, like, we look back on York as the lowest point, but at the time we didn't know it was the lowest point. Like, at the time it could have got lower. Like, you just don't know where things are going to go. So there was that trepidation at the time. But at the same time, we have to look at that era of City as not being in keeping with what City are. I mean, like, at the time, like, City were still one of the most successful clubs in England, and it was just like this was an anomaly in their history compared to where they'd been previously.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, because I suppose I can't speak for you guys, but I definitely, like, to me, there's almost a sense of, if I'm really honest, this place to Dan's point, like, I like, in a way, being able to view City's history as having had that low point, because I like the context that it paints the modern era in. And, like, the whole typical City thing, like, yeah, being in the third tier isn't actually typical City, but I think it's the way that they got there. And it's that it plays into that whole cups for cock-ups, bit of a laughing stock. People sort of liked City because they weren't United, and had a bit of good, at least my memory of it was that, like, the wider footballing public, like neutrals, tend to have quite a, at the time, had quite a positive feeling towards City because they were quite pitiful whilst United were not. And, but yeah, that isn't City's whole history.
Do you miss being liked like that?
No, it's not. I don't necessarily miss being liked, because it's sort of patronising, isn't it? Really, like to be liked because you're shit is like what's the point in that? No, there's loads of things that we've spoke about before, and inevitably we'll do again, that isn't great about like the other side of City's success and other things that you have to swallow to accept that. But I wouldn't trade it all just for being a bit more fondly regarded in by neutrals. No, not at all.
Yeah. I mean, I put the video up of York away on Tuesday, Dan, when it was the anniversary, and you would be surprised of the number of quote tweets and replies that I got that said along the lines of "before oil money." And like, it just isn't true, is it? Like, you look at where City were when they were taken over. Like, they got themselves out of that predicament as well. We shouldn't forget, like some of my fondest childhood memories are City, you know, sorting themselves out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's true that, like, you know, I think a few people made the point on Twitter this week that season was a blot on the graph of City's history rather than what is considered our rightful place. And I think we, as fans, confuse that a little bit as well. And I think the journey back to the top as a fan experience has been an incredible ride. I genuinely would not swap it with any other fan base in the entire world, what we've seen over the last 25 years. It's been so much fun and so, you know, unimaginable, really. And I think the York away stuff, we tend to use it, well, I certainly do, as a bit of a shield when people have a pop at the modern City and, you know, at the moment taunt us with the possibility of point deductions and relegations and all that. Like, it's our way of saying, like, there's nothing you can do to us that hasn't already been done. Oh, and actually, we enjoyed it last time, so the joke's on you.
Yeah.
Like, but it's just not true, that, is it? Like, it's a coping mechanism that, like, if we get relegated back to the third tier or whatever, it will be gutted. It will be devastating. I think we'd probably find the funny side quite quickly, but I think the joke would wear off equally as quickly as well when the reality sets in and, you know, all the good players leave and stuff. You know, maybe a year in the Championship would be a bit of a laugh, but, like, could you imagine having to go back to, you know, watching players like Lee Bradbury ever again? It'd be pretty horrible. And like, yeah. In a way, I identify more with that version of City than this current slick super club. But like, I think our rightful place is probably somewhere in the middle. We're probably a sort of middling Premier League club, if we're being honest with ourselves, aren't we, really? Mm. And I do actually miss being liked. I miss that sense of authenticity that people associated with City. And, you know, it's horrible to me to see that our reputation among other fans is like cheats and bought success and all this. Like, I kind of wish it wasn't that way. And often when you say to people now you're a City fan, you get a weird look. And I always have to get my key ring, my 99 playoff final key ring out to be like, I was there in the bad old days. Like, I'm not one of these Johnny come latelys.
Yeah. And does that stop the weird looks?
No, I get even more weird looks, if anything. But, you know, it makes me feel better.
Yeah. A final thought on York away then, in that case, because it's 25 years and I've done the typical thing of looking at the worst point in City's history 25 years on. And when I went back to all my interviews with the 99 team, and went to get the clips for that feature, what I found was the majority of them didn't want to talk about it. They didn't talk about York. They talked about Wrexham. They talked about the Stoke game afterwards and the start of the turnaround. And I guess, Richard, that's what we should focus on, really. The fact that, you know, City may have been at the lowest point 25 years ago this week, but actually the good story in all of this is the way they got out of it.
Yeah, and it's like, it's that idea of you don't necessarily appreciate the good times without the bad times. And that season, like just that season alone, we had the really, really bad first half of it where it seemed like everything was going wrong and we might be stuck down there. And then obviously, like, even if you extend that all the way to like the playoffs in their individual games, we were behind in the first minute of the first leg of the playoff and it feels like everything's going wrong, and then they come back and you have the great game at, or the great night at Main Road where we make it to Wembley, and then obviously Wembley sort of speaks Wembley for itself. Happens, yeah. Like the absolute despair to elation. And like you, I love that we have been, and again, I fully relate to like Dan's point of you wouldn't actually choose to go back there. But of course, I love that we were able to experience that and had to experience that because the upside is so, so high. It's the same thing as 2012, isn't it? Like the Aguero goal, it would have been amazing to win the league in any circumstance. But if you win that game 6-0, then the thrill isn't quite the same as being on the brink of one of the biggest chokes in English football history and instead having one of the most iconic moments in Premier League history. Like it's an amazing way to do things. You just never choose it beforehand.
There is a theme, isn't there, of City's existence in our lifetimes of despair to elation in such a short space of time, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dan, any favourite moments from the climb back up? Let's look at the positives of the years that followed. The Royal era, what are your best bits?
Well, Blackburn away the following season. I mean, that whole following season was pretty incredible, really, to see that we'd, you know, we were, the Phoenix was rising again, wasn't it, fully? And then obviously it sort of hit the glass ceiling quite quickly when it got back into the Premier League. But yeah, like Blackburn away was just a fantastic day where it's like, wow, we're back in the Premier League 2 years after you know, being thrown down to Division Three. It was just an amazing ride as well.
Mm. Yeah, Mark Kennedy's goal that day is still my favourite goal of all time. Just is. I can't help it.
And his celebration.
Yeah, yeah. Joe Royal shouts at him as he's running at him. Joe Royal shouts at him, "You fucking beauty!" And he's absolutely spot on. Let's kind of change tack now because we're going to talk about City's coming games. Let's start with Fluminense. I never thought this would be a City fixture, and neither did the Brazilian journalist and Fluminense fan Fred Caldeira. I've been speaking to him to find out what he makes of Friday's game.
I'm still getting used to this idea. It's something that I've never imagined it would happen. And I'm in an interesting position because by far I'm the Fluminense fan there. Have watched City the most in the world. And I'm probably the only person that follows City that has watched more than two matches of Fluminense.
You were at the Libertadores final, weren't you?
Yeah, it was last month on November when Fluminense won against Boca Juniors at Maracanã. And I was there in the stadium. I went to Rio just for the match. And yeah, that was the biggest match of our history so far. And Friday might be the new one.
Yeah. What are you expecting from Friday? I mean, there's, as you say, you're the Fluminense fan that has seen City the most. And like I'll be honest with you, I know absolutely nothing about the team other than I like the kit. Yeah. So other than the nice kit, what can you tell us about Flu?
Well, first, I think the first thing is to understand that the pressure's on City. I know that it's not a competition that maybe the majority of City fans like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it might be more of a nuisance than something that you dream of. But City are so far superior. They have, of course, Europe has way more money and conditions to buy the best players than South American clubs, including South American players. So the thing is an unequal match. So City should win this, I wouldn't say easily, but without suffering too much. But for me, the interesting one about this match, beyond the financial disparity, is that Guardiola is well known by being the juego de posición, the positional game, and Fluminense manager is kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So there is this big debate now in Brazil that while Pep likes to move the ball, Fluminense likes to move the players, if that's how I could put it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I did a podcast with Sam Lee earlier in the week, and he was telling me how he'd read that the Fluminense style was... the best way you could phrase it was kind of the anti-Guardiola, the complete opposite of Guardiola. What do you expect is going to happen on Friday?
I think they have more similarities than differences. That's why I don't think he's the anti-Guardiola. For example, he loves possession. So if you love possession, you must be close to Pep. Fluminense is not like a Simeone Atletico Madrid. He's not going to try to give the ball to City. But you know more than me that if you try to attack City, you might be welcoming a 4-0 to City. Yeah. So that's for me the big dilemma, because Fluminense is not used to have less possession in the South America environment. But of course, they will have less possession than City, because City are not used to give the ball to the opponent. So I'm curious to see how Fluminense will try first to survive and second to hurt City. We do have fast, which I say we, and you can say what side I'm rooting for. Sorry, David. But yeah, we do have fast counterattacks. So that could create problems in the left side, especially if Vardio plays, I don't know if you agree with me, he looks more vulnerable on that side. But again, I do think it's going to be fun to watch, but I don't know, City have 85% of chance of winning.
Yeah. In terms of individual players, like one of those, it's one of those things, you know, I haven't seen Fluminense play. So who are the players mm-hmm. that are key to making it work for you?
So I think the key, and that is something that is interesting because it could be similar to City as well. Rodri is the moving force, is the engine. And we have in that position our engine as well. He's called André. He's been playing for the national team now. He was under the radar of Liverpool last summer. Fulham, he might play in the Premier League in the second half of the season. We'll see if the offers will arrive this winter. So he is the one that makes the team moves around. But of course, we do have our number 10, Ganso. I don't know if you are familiar with him. He was in Santos alongside Neymar when both of them were kids coming from Santos Academy. For me, back in the day, I thought Ganso would be better than Neymar. And you see that I was wrong. So Ganso didn't have a great career in Europe. But in Brazil, he has been regarded as the last classic number 10. And yes, he is slow, but he makes the ball move. So he's this kind of the invisible man, another similarity with City.
Yeah.
So yeah, we do have these guys, and on the bench, this 12th player called John Kennedy, believe it or not. His dad used to love the US and thought it was a good idea to name his son as a former American president. But yeah, he is brilliant, really. 21 years old, and he scored every knockout stage in Libertadores, including the winning goal in the title. He scored in the semi-final of the Club World Cup, and he is brilliant. I think you'll see that.
Yeah. Obviously, we talked a bit earlier about, like you saying, Guardiola moved the ball and Fluminense like to move the players. How does that manifest itself in the course of games for Flu? Does it look a lot different to how we expect a kind of like a normal setup of a football match to look, if that makes sense?
I think it does. I think, I don't know, I can't see anyone doing something similar in the Premier League or in English football. It is weird. It is a risk and reward kind of thing. Like Fluminense, because the way they are set up and the way the manager believes they have to play, they do allow lots of counterattacks when they have the possession and they have the players in the opposition half. They do have some spaces defensive-wise. For example, our left side, we have Marcelo, former Real Madrid Marcelo, that is from our academy. He's our left back, and of course, he's not young. And our left centre-back is 40 years old. So in that gap there, in that pocket, Fluminense has one of their vulnerabilities. But if you look, like if you have the possibility of watching the game and seeing how the system works, you see how different it is, because the players, they like to merge. So it's not 11 players dividing the pitch on quarters and they have to fulfill their positions, even though they've swapped within themselves. And that's how Pep loves. Our manager loves to congest in one side. So many, in many situations, you see that we try to build up with 5-6 players within 5 meters of the pitch and slowly trying to create a stair kind of progression. So it is something that I don't find anything similar with in England.
There could be lots of space then for City here.
Yes, and that's what is making me a bit nervous. But it's going to be fun, and that is how I'm facing this game. Like, Fluminense has no pressure to win it because it's City. Come on, it's the best team in the world. It's the treble winners. And I think Fluminense style suits City in a good way for City, but it could also create problems because, I don't know, maybe this kind of stuff that Fluminense does could hurt City in a way. I don't know, because it's new, maybe.
Yeah, something they've never faced before. Well, Fred, I'm looking forward to it a lot. Could you give us a score prediction for the charity bet a bit later on in the show? I've got absolutely no idea where this could go. So over to you. You're the one who's most informed about this.
Well, I'm going to embrace the fun. So 4-2 to Manchester City.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Fred Caldeira talking to me about what to expect from Fluminense. Richard, how keen are you? We talked earlier on about the status of the Club World Cup. How keen are you to lift it at this stage now? They got to the final. You said before, they may as well, if you're in it, you may as well try and win it. But you look at what Fred says about the reaction in Brazil if Fluminense win it. Like, thousands of people will greet them at the airport as, you know, bring them home as like as huge champions. Whereas if City win it, I kind of imagine they'll be like
Elton John will be there.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody's going to go to the airport for that, are they? Surely.
No, I think it certainly feels lower stakes for City. And I wonder if some of that is, you know, we have like such a prestige attached to the Champions League that feels like in Europe, like once you've done that, you've already done the biggest thing that it's possible to do. And I do wonder whether in other continents, the idea of winning it almost means like surpassing or getting one over on what must feel at times. I'm aware of even saying this because I don't want it to sound like I'm in any way devaluing the game in other continents, but there's the Champions League is marketed, and European football and Premier League football is marketed around the world so well that for clubs in like decent leagues in like historical, like countries with a really historical football pedigree, like to get one over on those teams that must be rammed down your throat all the time must feel like a really, really good thing as well. And to go and almost, I can imagine that maybe it feels a little bit more like genuinely representing your continent than it does for European teams. And that's a lot of supposition on my part, and I might be talking absolute nonsense, but it's, I don't know. It sounds plausible to me. And it's just not, it's not that prestigious here, is it?
Yeah, well, the thing from Fred is ultimately you look at the resources that City have compared to the resources that Fluminense have. And it's like, it's so unbalanced that of course they're not expected to win the game. So the expectation is that they won't win it. So if they do win it, wow.
Yeah, and I guess the City is that, like, maybe it won't feel as big because it almost feels like they should win it. They do go there, I think, as the best team, as the best team in it, have been regarded for a while, you know, for a good period as probably the best team in the world. So yeah, I can definitely see that side of it. In answer to the question of, like, how much do I want to lift it, it'd be really nice to say City are world champions. Like, that would be a cool thing to be able to say. And it might be, you know, maybe the club would send us another medal to all wear personally as fans to celebrate that as well. That'd be great. But it won't ruin my night. I will make my plans for Friday. My son will get a later bedtime and stuff like that to make sure that I can watch the game to the end. But if they lose it, you know, it'll be turn the TV off and on with my evening.
Yeah. Speaking earlier, Dan, about great kits, Fluminense, what a kit that is. I love that one.
Yeah, so it's sort of like dark red and green, isn't it?
Yeah.
Quite Christmassy colours. Could that give them the edge? That's what I'm a bit worried about, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But as a man who clearly appreciates a good kit, unlike Richard, I'm looking forward to seeing this game because I want to see the kit in action. I think it looks great. A different challenge for Guardiola, this one, because when you listen to what Fred was saying about how they're likely to leave a lot of space, but kind of press the ball quite intensely with lots of players at all times, like, it could be quite interesting to see what Guardiola does with this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird one because it kind of feels like we're playing a pre-season friendly or something, or, like, you know, a during season friendly. It's kind of hard to get your head around it being a competitive game. I didn't see the game against URA Red Diamonds the other night.
Who was that? Sorry,
URA Red Diamond.
I see. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. It was your accent or something. I couldn't quite get.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, like everything Richard said is right, and the fact that we've gone there, you know, all that way, we might as well go out all out to win it and pick a strong team. And you know, I don't think Pep has an awful lot of options to play with in terms of rotation. I don't think he's going to put any youngsters in. And, you know, I'm thinking, like, you know, Kyle Walker could probably do with a rest, but if he's not getting a rest in the semi-final of the Club World Cup, then he's not going to get a rest in the final, surely. Equally, you know, we've got some important games in the league coming up, and it wouldn't be surprised if Pep had one eye on them. I think that would be only smart. But yeah, I hope we win it. I mean, I'm not going to be that upset if we don't either. I'm just kind of looking forward to logging off for work on Friday and sitting in front of the telly with a glue vine and seeing us hopefully become champions of the world. If I'm not mistaken, do you remember when United had to boycott the FA Cup that year to go into this competition? Didn't they get beat by a Brazilian team in it that year?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
I think Vasco da Gama, wasn't it, I think. So, you know, let's go one better than them, hopefully. That would be a bit of motivation.
Yeah. Dan, you mentioned Kyle Walker there as well. What have you made of his press conference this week, the comments that he made about basically defending himself, but also the recent record?
I think it's fair enough. I think he's going to defend himself, isn't he? And I think, you know, the backlash against him recently has been a little strange because he's not done a great deal wrong for me. I think people are just sort of like trying to find the culprit for the problems, and he's become a little bit of a whipping boy in that regard. That said, I would like to see him, you know, rotated out of the team a little bit. I would like to see us give a go again to the system that was so successful in the second half of last season when we had the four centre-backs and Stones stepping into midfield as a sort of right-back and you know, maybe a Kanji and Diaz as the centre-backs. And, you know, I don't think that role playing high up as a sort of winger really suits Walker that well. And I don't really understand why he just keeps being played. But at the same time, you know, he's still a very good player and, you know, the captain this season. So I think people have been a bit harsh on him.
Mm. Let's turn our attention back to the Premier League because it's Everton after Christmas. And it took me completely by surprise that we had to preview it on this show. I'm not going to lie. It's what happens at this time of year. You forget what day it is and everything, don't you? I've been speaking to David Downey from the Blue Room to find out how they're feeling about the season so far at Goodison.
Yeah, it's been, well, it's unprecedented really, isn't it? And I don't really want to go too far into the 10-point deduction and things like that. But if you look at how we were going up to that point, it was looking really good. We weren't exactly mid-table, but we weren't exactly fighting to stay in the Premier League at that point. It felt like there was growth coming from Dyche. It felt like we got into a style of play that suited us. By no means was it nice to watch, but it was really effective. I think the last win we had before that deduction came along was away at Crystal Palace. And it was a real physical battle, which it seems to affect us really well. And I think, I admit, when Dyche came in initially. I was like, this is just not going to work. We're going to go down here at some point. That's the last one after Lampard and all of the fuss we've had over the last few years. And what he's done, because I had a real stereotype against him for what he did at Burnley. Like, watching Burnley was really hard, regardless of when you watch them. Playing them away from home, it was just always a dreadful game. It always felt to me. Having him come in, having been sacked from there, I thought this isn't just going to work. And what he's done, again, isn't pretty to watch whatsoever. But it's slowly turned into what has been effective with the gang of players that we've got. Now, you look at that squad that we have right now, I think you'd look probably just about to half a dozen of that and think these guys are really good players. They can keep the ball. They want to attack all the time. They want to get as close to Calvert-Lewin as they possibly can, play a number 10, all that sort of thing. Decent wingers. That's really started to become an effect. And then lo and behold, we start the season. We lost our first four games of the season. And then automatically most of us are like, here's the panic situation already. But then again, it become to very really simple lineup that he used to come out with, and it worked. And it was almost too simple for many people to sit and watch, thinking, hang on, they couldn't get the head rounds. The fact that we, you know, played a 4-4-2 or a 4-5-1, and I can't imagine those players really told much about what they needed to do in training. And then it started to work really effectively. I think there was a lot more confidence on Dyche, and things settled down as much as I've seen in the last few years.
Yeah, it's interesting kind of how the season's gone, because I was looking at your Premier League results. So I've just taken the league form into account here. You mentioned the 10-point deduction. Obviously, you played United the weekend after that happened. And it was I watched that game because I figured there was a good chance the United could get a spanking in that. And I thought you were unlucky in the way that it went. But then you look at that result in and around everything else. Like, it's the only defeat since like the end of October. That's, you know, you've won four on the run. Before that, it was 1-2 and drawn one. So it's like you've got one defeat there in, you know, a time when City have been drawing, losing. So like you are much more informed than City are right now. The allegation was that the charges seem to have galvanized everybody, but I suspect that had already happened, had it?
Yeah, I'd go along well with that. I think I'd agree that, because like I said, it was just after that win away at Palace where that come along. United, the first one, that United game. It's interesting that you mentioned that. It was it was unprecedented. Like I said, we're all turning up at Goodison thinking, what's this going to be like? How do we get out of this? We've gone to bottom or 19th, whatever it was, and then we're 5 points without short of getting out of the relegation zone. But ironically, I say ironically, we've been doing this for the last 3 years. We're used to it, just at not that stage of the season. And like I said, the way in which we are playing, you look at the run of form there since that's happened. I think that we're typically that kind of side who loves back against the wall. When it comes to any alternative, i.e. the quarterfinal of the League Cup, that's when Everton start to struggle. No idea why, no idea how it's come about, but that feels to me a tradition from our club for many, many years. And that's a Goodison as well. And, you know, you look at that run of form. I think the last loss before that one against United was the derby as well. If you'd have told me at the derby, then you lose one more when you get up to what? Well, pretty much Christmas Day. We play Spurs 2 days before Christmas Day. I'd have been astonished by you saying that to me. And goes back to Dyche, really, once again. And I think, when he came in, when the way he talks, obviously does everybody's heads in anyway, doesn't it?
I didn't want to say it, but yeah.
Oh, no, mate, no. I mean, it is. You just feel like running up to him saying, please, mate, just cough. Just do one cough and you'll be absolutely fine. And there's a real simplicity about him, I think, when he talks, and it's all straight back down the line. You're never going to get a controversial comment from him or anything like that. It's always, we played well, we deserved better. we've got a load of injuries, you know, so, you know, that was the best we could do, all that sort of thing. And in sort of a long time, that's exactly what we've needed. And it's massively ironic, really.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned the form. Who's playing well at the moment, or is it literally just everybody right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that Jared Branthwaite has probably led as much better than anybody else has, because he's... It's funny that he's a centre-back that's sort of galvanised everybody else around him. I don't think many clubs would say that about players who play in that position, really, because they're obviously in a limited position where they can get the team moving forward and they can create chances and whatnot. It's more how well he handles things. He's calm, as you could imagine, the best of centre-backs to be. I'd say he's been superb, but in fact, alongside him has been Mykolenko. He's been absolutely brilliant for quite some time now. He epitomises the way in which the club's been, i.e. somebody who comes in who, you know, you don't think he's going to do well. You think he's got every battle in the world against him, yet he's the mentality on what he does, he's just ideal at left-back. It reminds me a little bit of Zinchenko that you guys had back at that time, where you'd think, you know, he grew into a position that you didn't necessarily think you were going to get the best from. He's somebody you bring in who you think, do you know what, he's probably on the bench, he'll probably come on after an hour in most games, he's just back up for whatever you've got a left back. All of a sudden now, he's been key to us actually scoring goals. He knows how to go forward, he knows how to track back. That is pretty much an understatement of what else we've got on the other side with Ashley Young, who, you know, people would pay him not to play for us again. so, yeah, it's funny who stands up when you think necessarily you need a dominant midfielder, you need a striker who's just going to bang the goals in. And I do think that that's slowly developed as well. Again, talking about Onana because of that penalty, he'll be at the bottom of many people's lists. I think he's gone very high and low. And yeah, I think he's got everything. He's one of those lads who will become a top-class player. I think that's undoubted in what I see from him. But it's difficult to say about him becoming that way at Everton, because I think that requires people in and around him to do the exact same to make him be able to do what he wants to do. And then, of course, more lately, I think McNeil as well. I put him at the top of the list recently, scored some really crucial goals for us. He's actually our top goal scorer at the moment as well. So, yeah, there are a good few, but I'd just about give it to Mykolenko. And you give me 6 months ago, I certainly wouldn't be putting him as the top 20 in the side. There's one guy I haven't even mentioned in what we were talking about there. And I say that with a smile. I think most fans say it with a smile because of what we initially saw, what we initially thought we were getting, and that's Beto. Now, most fans of most other clubs won't have seen what this guy's like. He reminded me of Paolo Wanchope. In some games, you would think, how's this guy a professional footballer? But in other games, you'd think, this guy's world class because he can run around people. He's lightning quick and he's 6'4", 6'5".
Is it like having a daddy long legs in the team? That's what I always thought Wanchope was like. Yeah.
Yeah. He'll tackle himself. you know, that type of player, but he's slowly, I mean, his attitude, the way he came in, he was talking about when he worked in KFC and all this sort of thing, when he was doing an interview when he first came in, and we were like, why have we gone and paid? Well, we're going to pay 30 million in some sort of probably £5 a week or whatever we've done to go and get him. And he's been forced to come in because Calvert-Lewin still not 100% fit. He hasn't been for well over a year now. Needs to come off, and he generally does on 60. This lad comes on, and he, obviously, as you can imagine, big guy. He's a focal point of how you want to get out of your own half, somebody who you want to hand it up. But there's a different style from him, one that's quite rare, because you don't often get big boys who are particularly quick. But this lad is rapid. He's absolutely rapid, almost a little bit like Lukaku, but obviously nowhere as good as him in finishing. And now you look at him and think, give him the ball, he's going to do something magic at some point, but probably awful at the rest of it. So, you know, he's going to start in one of the two, given how short they are apart in Spurs and City. I'd throw him in against City because I think that's something that you're not mostly won't have expected out of a forward all season long, to be honest with you. It could be completely different for your defenders to try and win against.
Yeah. Let's talk about Goodison as well, because it feels like, looking from the outside, it feels like the deduction has really kind of ramped up the feeling inside Goodison. Now, listen, I'm old enough to remember what Main Road was like when things got poisonous around there. Hearing stories of what Goodison can get like in previous years about getting on the players' backs. Is the atmosphere good at the moment? The team's winning games. It feels like there's something to fight against, that sort of thing. Is it hard for opposing teams at Goodison these days?
That's a really good question, and hard one to answer, really. I don't think it's been like it previously was. I'd even go back to Lampard, to even say Benitez, because it was strangely as big as you imagine. You want, like you referred to Main Road there, when you were able to get an atmosphere, particularly in those night games too, that's where, you know, everybody's on their toes screaming all the way through the game, and you think there's no way anybody's going to score a goal against us. We play a style of football, and a guy I was sitting next to said to me, I'm not coming back here to watch Everton. It's a 1-1 draw at home to Brighton, who've been a really good side until they've started losing games recently. They had about 75% of possession, but Everton go 1-0 up and really shouldn't have lost the game. They scored an equaliser in the last minute. That to me epitomises what Dyche is. But then I've got people next to me saying, I'm not watching this. This is not what you want to see from Everton, which is strange, because the whole dogs of war thing, and Joe Royle, you know all about him as well, of course. Those days are what I sort of refer to what Dyche is very much like. The way we win games, you're not playing pretty football by any means whatsoever, but you're getting those results. I think there's a feeling at Everton amongst our fans at Goodison that, you know, we should be a hell of a lot better given what's gone on. The 10-point deduction has probably hit everybody in the wrong place, in the middle of the ball, really, since before that we signed so many players. The main issue for everybody was we've been just ridiculous with recruitment and signed so many poor players, and we could only sell them for a small percentage of what we bought them for. That made Goodison really angry, but it made Goodison what you want it to be with the way in which the games used to come by. And now I still think it's in limbo. Starts to get back. I mean, you look at the last two games at home, aside from the quarterfinal there, Chelsea and Newcastle, we ripped them apart. And by ripped them apart, I think we actually played again, kept the ball on the floor.
I must admit, I'm nervous about this being a night game, you know.
Yeah, and that's I think you're right. I think that's a very traditional Everton style. That's like, you know, most lads go in the game, go and have a pint an hour before, and then you head to the ground, and everybody's ready for this. You know, everybody can't wait for the game to kick off, and everybody's singing the songs and whatnot. Nonetheless, we need to keep in our mind that it is against Manchester City. But yeah, you're right. I think that's the best night you're going to get at Goodison. Night game at Goodison, in my opinion, is best time to get a win, best time to play Manchester City if we're going to get anything.
Yeah. Let's talk about that then, because we've got the charity bet coming up. What do you see happening in this one? Because City are out of form, but obviously they're in the Club World Cup at the moment, so we don't really know what we'll get when they come back. And Everton are in form. Are you fancying your chances for this one? Let's have a scoreline.
Strangely so, because I'm normally regarded and given all sorts of abuse for being a negative Everton fan. I think we'll get a draw from this. I really do. I think, referring to what you said there about going to Goodison at night, I think against the better sides, when we tend to step up, that's why we're such an infuriating side. You know, we lost 2-1 at home to Luton earlier in the season, and we're all sitting there thinking, well, if we won that 3-0, then we'd be, what, 11 points clear, even with a 10-point deduction from the bottom three. That's the kind of side we are. City, we referred to there about the crowd and things like that, will be massively up for this. I think that what's happened with you guys has astonished me in recent weeks, recent games. Nonetheless, with Liverpool going up there at the moment, but Arsenal as well. It's and Aston Villa, it's really fascinating what's going on there in the top four or five. But yeah, I think we can go get a draw. In fact, I'm quite confident we get a draw, strangely, at home to City, because that's not the type of place you want to go to when you've been out and about all over the world playing games and, you know, Club World Cups and whatnot. I think it's going to be 1-1. because we used to playing against sides who have most of the ball. We used to, you know, good sides, and obviously they don't come any better than City. You know, the way in which you approach games as well, which, you know, imagine being on the edge of the 18-yard box, or you're just passing it round for fun. Everton can handle that. Everton are decent at that. That's the one thing that I think we've done best this season. And Dyche will be relatively comfortable with that. Goes the other way. Set pieces. You know, you start somebody like Berto. You Calvert-Lewin may well start. And you've got a couple of lads who, I think Mikhailenko's going to be fit again. Right side's a bit of an issue. I think we get crosses in, I think, in a much more physical way. I think we'll cause City some problems. So, I think we'll get a 1-1 draw.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
That was David Downey from the Blue Room. Richard, this is probably the wrong time to be running into Everton, isn't it?
Yeah, the wrong time for the Premier League Charges derby. Well, they've really picked up, haven't they? They look like they were picking up before they had a cause to really rally against. And I mean, if you think the state they were in when we went to Goodison Park towards the end of last season, and they look for all the world like they probably go down and carried that some of that into the start of this season. And now all of a sudden you look at it and it's almost impossible to think of them being in a proper relegation scrap, other than obviously they've got the points to make up for the deduction that they got. But even then, I mean, that might change on appeal anyway. And even then, it's not like it dropped them right to the bottom of the league, was it? So I think that speaks to how much they've picked up. I think it's obviously historically a ground that City used to really struggle at. It is a ground where the fans can create a hell of an atmosphere, and I think have been doing ever since that points deduction. And yeah, I'd be lying if I said it was a game I was completely confident about. It doesn't. It's not the game that you want when you're out of form yourself. If City were in top form, then I'd back them to deal with all of those factors.
Yeah, bring on all comers, sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but now I don't have that same level of confidence, to be fair.
Yeah, we talked earlier, Dan, about the Club World Cup and kind of it being a nice distraction at this stage when the form has been as it is. Let's say things go well on Friday night, they've won that and they've put in a decent performance. Does that blow the cobwebs and do they get back to what they used to be? Is it a help in resetting where things need to be?
I don't know. I can't imagine it will have much bearing on anything. If anything, it might create more cobwebs. we knew always going into the season where it was going to fall in the season, and I think it has to be looked at as a nice novelty, but one that might ultimately not be very good for us. A bit like, I don't know, Bailey's this time of year or something. but yeah, I'm dreading this trip to Goodison as well. Like Richard said, I think they're going to be extra fired up to beat us since we're, you know, somehow a villain in there. Season-long revenge mission, and
yeah,
we should be
kindred spirits, shouldn't we?
We should be, really. Yeah, we should be hands across the M62 and all that. But it's not going to be like that, is it? Really? And I've got a feeling it could be a really, really tough watch, especially if we're still a bit jet lagged coming back from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. After the recent run, Dan, what do you want to see from them at Goodison?
Well, to paraphrase David Moyes famously being paraphrased, I think we must improve in a number of areas, including passing, creating chances and defending.
Right, fair enough.
So, does that answer your question?
Yeah. It kind of gives me an idea of where you're at the minute as well with how you're feeling about City.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they've got to defend better than they have been. They've got to keep the ball better. They've got to create chances. They've got to take chances. They've got to hope and they've got to pray. I think it's that really. I think it's going to be a really hard game.
Yeah, it's ultimately, is it a case, Richard, of concentration for 90 minutes? Because you cut out individual errors. You put in a performance like Palace, but you cut out the individual errors. You probably win, I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's always like the most useless thing to say, really, but that is sort of like permanently true of City, that if City play their best against anybody and don't make mistakes, then they'll beat anybody, won't they? Because that's the quality that they've got. And Everton, no matter how informed they are, the same is true of this game. If City go there and suddenly are back to their very, very best, they're not making individual mistakes, then that leaves Everton with a lot less room to do anything because City can control a game against anyone. And so, yeah, like I'd really like to see them cut out the individual mistakes and be able to retain the ball in the way that we are used to. And then I'm pretty confident that they'd win. But it's, you know, if Haaland's fit, it's helpful if he doesn't miss open nets as well, because you win a few more games if he doesn't do that. Most of the time, he doesn't do that. Most of the time, he's at least getting them on target. But so, yeah, I want them to be at the best, and that would be enough. But I think maybe the way things have been the last six Premier League games, there's probably a few bumps in the road in individual games yet. And maybe we need to go through this kind of game where actually it is going to be tricky and there's probably going to be some dicey moments. But if you see it through and come out with a narrow win, then maybe in the long run, that's more helpful than going out and winning at a canter, because you remind yourself that you can grind it out. And that feels like a bit more of what City need at the moment. That said, I won't turn my nose up at a 4 or 5 nil either. But
yeah, I just wondered what Guardiola would say in the dressing room to get them to stop making mistakes. He'd like going around the dressing room going, Haaland, just score the goals. You know, stop giving the ball away. Like how do you just make them play better? I don't know. It's probably why he's in the dugout and I'm not. Dan, Richard mentioned the atmosphere at Goodison. There's almost a sense of that they need to go there and quieten the crowd, because just as the Premier League charge, well, the deduction for Everton has really sort of, I don't know if it's galvanised them in favour of the team or against the Premier League. I've not decided yet. But it feels very much like Luton, that they've got to keep the ball, kill the atmosphere to start with.
Yeah, and we have been quite good at doing that over the years, you know, sort of grinding teams into submission and making games quite boring sometimes. And I think that's going to be quite key here. If we can do that, then we've got a chance. I feel like as well, you know, sympathy is always in short supply when City are doing badly, isn't it? You know, we never really get the sort of, you know, anybody making excuses for us or anything like that. I kind of feel like we do a little bit of luck or just something else intangible that sees a bit of a change in fortunes. I don't think we're playing that badly. I don't think we're doing a lot wrong, and we don't usually make as many mistakes. So, you know, I think if we can concentrate, tighten up a bit, hope that the we get the rub of the green, then we should be all right. And I think overall, for what's, you know, the rest of the season, the second half of the season, it's not what does City have to do to change, but can they change? Like, are they capable enough of doing it this season? Have they got the depth and the energy to keep winning trophies? Are they going to be better than Arsenal and Liverpool? I really hope so. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll find out over the next few weeks, I guess. Ali Fogg correctly predicted the 3-0 win against URA Red Diamonds, somehow without even knowing the opposition at the time. Make of that what you will. Maybe blind luck is a good factor here. Either way, we're now on £550 raised for the charity bet. The money is going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're helping the Trussell Trust and Manchester Central Food Bank tackle poverty in Manchester. William Hill is giving us 3 £10 correct score singles on City's games. We heard earlier on for the Fluminense game that Fred has gone for an entertaining 4-2 win for City. That's 45-1 and £450 if he's right. So I hope he is. Dan, what are you having for this?
2-1 to City.
2-1 City is 8-1 and £80. Richard?
I'm saying 3-1, David.
3-1 is 10-1 and £100. And then David Downey went for 1-1 at Goodison Park, which is 7-1 and £70. Richard, what are you having for this?
I'll go 2-0 City.
2-0 City is 15-2 and £75. And Dan?
For what I think is the first time ever on the podcast, I'm predicting City to lose 1-0.
Yeah. Yeah. When you sent that over, I was like, right, that's where he is he?
Yeah. Rattled.
Yeah. So 1-0 Everton is 16-1 and £160 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more on gambling responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. And that's the end of today's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks also to my guests for this one, Richard Burns.
Thank you very much.
And Dan Burke.
Thanks a lot. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Season's greetings, everybody. It is the Christmas quiz up next, so join a load of us on Christmas Day for some City-related mayhem. We'll then review whatever happens at Goodison next week. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
I had to watch this at my granny and granddad's house. I wasn't allowed to watch it downstairs because nobody else in the house wanted to watch football. anyone who's interested in football had gone to the pub. So I watched it upstairs on a tiny 14-inch portable TV. It was just the elation that I felt from the Rosler chip to then just the absolute...
It's the injustice, isn't it?
It was a fucking disgrace. Like, even as a kid, I just felt like... That feeling now, just talking about it, has just come back to me, and it's just burned into my chest, and I can feel my face getting red now about it.
Let's have a positive memory from the game, because Rosler's goal, what was your reaction as soon as, like, he's going clean through, he's one-on-one with Schmeichel, like, you can't be expecting him to do what he did.
I screamed the house down, and I remember adults coming upstairs, like my aunties and stuff.
Are you all right?
No, telling me off, telling me that my younger cousins were, like, you know, asleep and stuff like that. But yeah, I just went absolutely berserk, and yeah, I just got told off.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.